Welcome to WBOY Presents. I'm Sean Beter. In this episode, we're featuring a panel discussion with IPFW professors James Toole and Ann Lifshitz about the crisis in Crimea. This discussion was recorded at IPFW on Wednesday, March 5th. Here's our moderator, IPFW political science professor Andrew Downs.
Thank you, everybody, for coming today. This is a presentation, a panel discussion we're calling a crash course on the crisis in Crimea. And before we get into things, I want to let you know that it's being sponsored by the Departments of History and Political Science, as well as the American Democracy Project here at IPFW. We want to thank Nicole Wilkins from the Chancellor's Office and Kathleen Caracella from the College of Arts and Sciences for helping to let people know about this event on rather short notice. We also want to thank IPFW Special Events for helping us set up audio so that it could be captured and then recorded and broadcast by the fine folks at NIPR. My name is Andy Downs. I will be moderating today's discussion. And the panelists are, beginning closest to me, James Toole from the Department of Political Science and Ann Lifshitz from the Department of History. So the title is a crash course on the crisis in Crimea, but more generally it's actually about Ukraine. But let's go ahead and have Ann just tell us some of the events that have sort of captured our attention regarding Ukraine. Why are we actually suddenly paying attention to what's happening in Ukraine?
Well, Ukraine has actually been in the news since November of 2013. And one of the big reasons for that is that at around that time, fairly unexpected protests began in Ukraine. Now, the initial protests began as a response to this kind of last-minute arbitrary decision on the part of the former Ukrainian government, to not sign an association agreement with the European Union. And even though this was not a welcome to the EU kind of agreement that they said no to, it had tremendous cultural and symbolic value. I mean, the idea was that this was something that was supposed to pave the way for Ukraine to be a member of the European family, the European family of nations. And so the initial protests, young people protesting, the ones who felt kind of most aggrieved by this blanket denial of this symbolic European future that they were looking forward to. And in the initial protests, the government first tried to ignore them, then the government started trying to disperse them in a very violent and brutal way. And this is where things began to escalate because the initial protesters were very young, photogenic young people who also, as many young people are apt to do, were very well versed in using social media to promote themselves and their particular cause. More and more people started coming to the square, and it really stopped being about the EU. And it really became about arbitrary decisions on the part of the government, the repressions on the part of the government. And so more and more people from different walks of life, different ages, different backgrounds, started to come together and protest. And this has been going on since late November.
So, Jamie, in terms of reaction, it's the protests that really kind of got everyone's attention. And what has, since this sort of started as a reaction to something involving the EU, what's the EU's reaction been, or for that matter, the UN's reaction been?
Mm-hmm. Well, so far, not much. And I think later on we're going to talk about specific things that are in the works right now or that could be done in the next few days, weeks, or months. So we'll leave that aside. So far, not a whole lot. There also aren't that many options, as we will discuss later on as well. So that's part of the reason that not much has happened right away. And of course, nobody thinks it would be a good idea to use military force in any way here, you know, from the EU or NATO or the United States or anybody else. So that's not even, of course, on the table. I just mentioned one thing that Anne brought up, and of course I agree with her on this, but I want to make a special point about it. The EU agreement that was turned down at the last minute by the Ukrainian government, as Anne rightly said, was not a membership agreement, and there seems to be some misunderstanding about that. Ukraine is nowhere close to joining the European Union. In fact, it hasn't even been invited to begin the very long process by which a country joins the European Union. The European Union is very hard to get into because it has tremendous sort of requirements for joining. But this is a kind of agreement that the EU reaches with a number of countries on the periphery of the European Union that provides a lot of benefits to those countries and reciprocal benefits to the EU. But this was not at all an issue of EU membership.
These protests have been going on for several months now, which is, in the grand scheme of things, kind of a long time for protests to be going on. How is it they've managed to have this kind of longevity?
It appears that And I think this is something that really surprised a lot of people both in Ukraine and outside as well, that there's sort of this general assumption that the people in the former Soviet Union are fairly docile, sort of frightened people who just want to get on with their lives. And so the commitment that that the Ukrainian people who have been taking part in the demonstrations have demonstrated is really kind of remarkable and has certainly captured the attention of perhaps not everybody, but certainly of some people. Part of what kept going was both, again, sort of the commitment of the participants and the fact that the government was dealing with it in a very, very problematic way. And so each time it appeared that maybe some agreement would be reached, maybe finally something would get resolved and people would finally be sent, you know, be sent home. Horrible kind of violent repressions would begin anew that created sort of and I don't mean to diminish the sacrifices made, but I mean that they were transformed into very effective PR opportunities for the protesters, right? Having these young people brutally beat up, having the government having the government do this in a variety of ways, pretending that it's not, but actually, doing it, hosing people down with cold water in very cold weather, and in particular, in the last couple of weeks, the protesters, the violence has really, really escalated, and this is something that kind of very much cemented the resolution on the part of the participants to not give in because the stakes have increased so dramatically over time.
But of course, protesting, there should be some sort of an accomplishment that people can point to. What have the protests been able to accomplish so far?
Well, the president is now the former president in hiding in Russia, and periodically on Twitter, rumors of his death begin to, you know, get circulated. So I mean, that's a pretty big accomplishment. Part of the concern, I mean, part of what was happening during this very long period of protests is that in response to, I mean, part of it was just kind of very bad political maneuvering. Yanukovych, somebody kind of very much kind of in the Soviet mold politically, not necessarily ideologically, but sort of mentality and strategy, thought that maybe one way of dealing with this problem is now that EU has been sort of is off the EU direction is off the table, modeling a lot of the repressive laws on Russia, and in particular, cracking down on the press freedom, on freedom to assemble, and all of these other things that the protesters were taking advantage of, this effort to model the changes on Russia really backfired against him. He tried to suspend the constitution. He literally was trying to transform the country into a dictatorship, using Russian laws. And some of the in addition to ousting him, the return to the previous constitution, the one that was that would not rolling back some of the changes that he made. Those are also very, very important accomplishments for the protesters. And then last. The last two that I want to mention very quickly demonstrate. I mean, I think again the surprise that so many people have that protests can go on for this long in a region that's not really known for its protests is definitely an accomplishment as well. It's not clear what this is a coalition. The protesters are an ever increasing and wide coalition representing lots of different political forces. But they're clearly positioning themselves as a force to be reckoned with and that cannot simply be dismissed. And it's starting to reverberate even in places like Russia. I mean, the initial reaction in Russia by the people who opposed Putin was actually jealousy, right? How the hell is it we tried our protests and they petered out after a couple of weeks and that's that. And those Ukrainians, right, in that kind of hierarchy, the ethnic hierarchy, that's the same one that Putin possesses, that the Russian opposition to Putin has as well. How is it that our little Slavic brothers managed to have these protests go on this long and get something accomplished when ours just disappear and nobody cares?
Whenever there's a change in leadership, you do have to sort of wonder what that does to international perception. So in this case, Jamie, what have the EU, the UN for that matter, the US, thought of the changes, the internal changes that have taken place because of the protests?
Well, to some degree, of course, there's been a lot of sympathy and not a whole lot of sympathy for the outgoing president, but a lot of sympathy for, of course, the people in the streets and the protests. And so that is clear. And we see that among a lot of, for example, Westerners who are following this story. At the same time, that sympathy is, of course, also laden with some concern over the course of events, over the sort of seemingly incoherent nature or at least temporary nature of the government running Ukraine right now. There's some concern over specific decisions that the new government has made. For example, it doesn't seem very magnanimous when you've just kicked out your president to decide to, and in a situation in which there is ethnic division in the country, to, for example, restrict the use of Russian as an official language in Ukraine. I mean, that just seemed like a really poor start to a government that might be able to sort of draw Ukrainians more together. So there are certainly questions about those kind of things. There are big questions about the future of the Ukrainian economy, which was already in bad shape. And we can talk more later about aid packages. So I'll leave that for now. I would say one more thing, though, is that even though I think sympathy has been the norm throughout much of the world, there are also people who do at least have some sympathy with Vladimir Putin's argument. You don't have to like Putin to believe that there might be something to his concerns about Western encroachment upon regions within the former Soviet Union. And this dates back a long way, but in the last quarter century, it dates back to concern to Russian anger, for example, over the entry of the Baltic states, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania into NATO and subsequently into the EU. And so there are people who say, maybe I don't like Putin, but I sort of do understand this kind of, annoyance at the very least at what one might view as Western encroachment.
Well, Ukraine's certainly one of those places that fall under the sphere, could theoretically fall under the sphere of Russia today. But where has Russia fit into what's happening right now?
I think the best way up until the events of the last couple of days, the best way to characterize what Russia's attitude has been profound irritation. Sort of the idea that people that you simply view as your younger brothers, temporarily separated from you by some unfortunate, post-collapse development, and who should really sort of pay, who should kind of follow the cues coming from Moscow, who are now, it was bad enough when it was happening in December, but as things went into February, and this was supposed to be Putin's crowning, shining moment to showcase Russia and its strength and power and ability to manage issues of all kinds for the Olympics, having the world's attention drawn, drawn to that instead of instead of Putin, was profoundly irritating. And so for quite some time, Russian media kind of very systematically worked to discredit whatever it was that was going on in Ukraine, the tremendous effort put forward to discredit it, seen as the protesters were seen as trained in the West, bought by the West, trying to sell Ukraine and Russia while they were at it, to the West. A lot of sort of homophobic kind of elements to it, that first step, that the EU is really just doing it sort of to promote the gay agenda of the West, and kind of shove it down everything of the people in this region. And there's been a lot of effort to try to, one of the really remarkable things about this is that just how successful the Russian propaganda actually has been in some ways in setting in the way that the conversations about the protests have been taking place. In particular, sort of the idea that these are all fascists, that this is a fascist revolution, that these are fascists trying to sell out Ukraine. That kind of rhetoric, kind of very specifically, and I'll talk about the image in just a second. That rhetoric, kind of very carefully calibrated in Moscow, that has been picked up in the West as well, including even at IPFW, the PAX wall in liberal arts, sort of suggesting that if you view favorably the, somebody anonymously suggested, that if you view the revolution favorably, you must be a Nazi, right? I mean, are there right-wingers involved in the protest? Yes, it's a very broad coalition, right? Do we know which way this is gonna go? No, we don't, right? But the ultimate stems from the Russian desire to discredit the movement, and again, kind of how successful it is. These are just some of the examples, kind of Ukrainian propaganda machine fighting back against the Russian propaganda machine. the image on the left makes it appear as if lots and lots of people are demonstrating in Ukraine in support of Russia. And the image on the right is where is the kind of panning out from that, that shows that, yes, the flag is very big, but the group of people carrying the flag is actually very, very small, right? I mean, essentially the same image, but depending on how you crop it, it has a completely different, has a completely different dimension to it. And I think we have a few more images kind of talking about the different ways. And again, just to be clear, right, I mean, these are all, a lot of these have been put together by somebody who's definitely interested in trying to discredit the Russian propaganda. The image on top, these are the images of the Russian, local self-defense units, spontaneously forming on the territory of Crimea, and on the bottom, these are the people, the bottom photograph was a photograph of one of the protesters, and these were the people that the Russian propaganda characterizes as having been professionally trained and funded by the CIA, right? The message, the juxtaposition between them, right? Which of these looks more plausibly like they are self-generating, and which one doesn't? This is a great image. These are actually the police units that were used to attack and brutalize and in many cases kill the protesters. They always had masks on their faces, and this was a big thing among the protesters. They wanted to identify them, hence the masks. This is them at a ceremony in Russia where they've been granted Russian citizenship. So the picture, I found a picture where somebody was making a joke that I wonder if in their passport photos they still have, the masks on even in their, in their passport photos. But this is sort of Russia is rescuing them because, of course, if they remain in Ukraine, there's a chance that they might, bad things might happen to them kind of as revenge. And so they've been saved and brought into Russia for those purposes.
So, and for the people who would like to see more of these sorts of images, obviously you have a variety of feeds coming to you. Do you have a couple of places where you might suggest people go take a look just to, and it's going to be hard for you to pick one or two, but there's a couple that you might recommend people go look at?
One of the interesting things is that, and I think that the Ukraine is not the first place that started doing that. I mean, I think it started with Arab Spring, and especially with Turkey last summer, where there was a very conscious effort to get in social media, places like Twitter, and constantly kind of provide information in English about the things that are going on. So there's actually a Twitter account called Euromaidan, Euromaidan. Obviously, it's a pro-protesters one, but the nice thing about it is it has images, but it's also in English.
I'm going to, for those of you in the audience, we'll show a few more images up here, but I do want to get back to sort of what's been, what is it about March 1st that sort of changed the game as far as Russia is concerned?
Well, on March 1st is a very exciting day because this is the day that Putin went to the Russian parliament and requested permission to requested authorization to deploy troops to protect Russians in Crimea. In a shocking turn of events, unanimous vote approved this request. An even more perhaps shocking turn of events, it turns out that they were there already. So that there is kind of that there was various comments, again, social media saying these armed people, we're not quite sure who they are, but they kind of keep showing up. They're very well armed. They keep kind of making way towards our Ukrainian military bases. And then sort of the official explanation, sort of, oh, right, of course, these are, this is the Russian army. At least on March 1st and 2nd, this was officially proclaimed to be the Russian army coming in to rescue Russians. Who were being abused by all the Ukrainian nationalists. These were the last two images are actually pro-war parades in Moscow. I know, pro-war parades. There are also anti-war ones too. This one is particularly creepy because I don't know if people can see close. If people who see it close enough, you can see the uniforms these people are wearing are World War II era uniforms. And the flag that they are carrying, it says the Third Ukrainian Front. The Third Ukrainian Front was the army that actually liberated Eastern, was liberated anyway. entered Eastern Europe. Right. So it has this very heroic World War II era connotation, and it's a perfect example of this kind of conflation in people's minds that this is as part of the propaganda on the part of the Russian regime that these are fascists, these are Nazis. The image right before that, kind of people in German uniforms. Oh no, sorry. That one. This is one of the jokes on Twitter that this is what Russian television makes it appear that Kiev is like, right? A bunch of, you know, people in SS uniforms sort of riding in public transportation down the street, and you get that even, I mean, various sort of YouTube clips of talking to people who seem to be conflating World War II and contemporary events. I mean, and they don't seem like they're suffering from dementia, right? I mean, there's just this sort of, you know, this is like the fascists. The Germans are coming. We need the troops here to protect us from the fascists and the Germans. Which Germans? Well, you know, the Germans. You remember the Germans. I mean, it's just kind of really, really profoundly, terrifying and disturbing at the same time that people could internalize the propaganda to such an extent.
Now, I'm going to bring up, I encourage people to go look at maps of the area, obviously, but I'm bringing up a map of Ukraine right now, in part so that we can talk about Crimea more specifically. And Jamie, if you would, explain part of the significance of this territory.
Well, maybe the single most important thing is that for a very, very long time, Russia, or national security strategists in Russia, and by a very long time I mean for hundreds of years, have sought out a warm water port, or sought out access to warm water ports, because if you think of a map of Russia, you know, what you see is a very northerly country with no real open water on its southern edge. So in the winter, particularly in harsh winters, the Russian Navy traditionally has been locked up in port or sent out to sea to await the breakup of the ice in the northern reaches of the ocean. So, you know, Russia has had this perennial search for access to warm water ports. And so it's significant. And here we have a map of Europe showing that, one of the few traditional outlets Russia has, of course, is through the Black Sea. And so Russia has an important port, important naval bases in Crimea, and uses them, has been using them with Ukraine's permission. And that allows, of course, Russian naval vessels to go out through the Bosphorus Straits, through Turkey, and then out into the Mediterranean, and thereby out into the open sea. So the national security and strategic reasons for Russia's interest in Ukraine are quite powerful.
But how Crimea became part of Ukraine is an interesting story in and of itself, regardless of its military advantages.
Right. I had a conversation with somebody when this started happening, who said, well, but Crimea has always been a part of the Russian Empire. And so I had this dramatic pause at the idea that when you're talking about an empire, that anything can really be always a part of an empire as a natural phenomenon. So Crimea was a territory that was essentially annexed under Catherine the Great in the late 18th century. This was a territory that was part of the by that time it was annexed. It was the kind of the leftovers of the Crimean Khanate, sort of the descendants of the of Genghis Khan, kind of long past the glory phase, right? I mean, if we're thinking about Russian expansion, they wait till somebody gets really weak, and then they go after it. So they waited. They had to wait. I mean, they wanted the Black Sea for quite some time, but they waited until the Crimean Tatar community was not going to be able to put up much of a fight. So this is a very this is not a traditional ethnic Russian, Russian area, although certainly through policies of kind of population manipulation, there was a lot of effort to have ethnic Russians move into the region in order to change the demographic composition. Most recently, it remained an area with a very high Crimean Tatar concentration, who were deported out of the region in 1944 by Stalin for alleged treasonous behavior during World War II. So they were essentially, and the entire people were picked up and shipped out to much colder, less hospitable places, and about 60%, I think. Either 40 or 60% of them died on the way there, right? Because again, like 1944, this is not the time. These were not very comfortable transportation arrangements. So as a result, again, sort of the ethnic composition of the region changed. And then kind of most significantly for this particular conflict, in 1954, Khrushchev gave Crimea to the Ukrainian Republic as a gift, as a 300th anniversary of being part of the same, country kind of gift. And of course, at the time, it seemed like a deeply symbolic gesture, right? It doesn't really matter which republic of the Soviet Union Crimea was really going to be in. When the Soviet Union collapsed, however, it turned out that it did very much matter, right? And it has both, as Professor Tuul pointed out, I don't want to downplay the military significance of this, of course, but it also resonated very much with ordinary people, because Crimea is a very popular resort destination. And so the idea that this lovely place that was that where Russian, you know, people from all over the Soviet Union could go to, now suddenly for Russians is in a foreign country, was deeply and profoundly offensive, right? I mean, there's a kind of a range of reactions that ordinary people in the former Soviet Union had to the collapse of the Soviet Union. This one hurt, right? I mean, I think that there's not that much crying about, you know, losing, I don't know, Belarus, for example. But Crimea really, really hurt. And so there is that kind of symbolic, kind of the military and symbolic aspect of it that rankles, which explains those parades. I mean, most of the parades are not genuine parades. People were shipped from work. I mean, essentially people were bussed in from various state enterprises to go into these parades, handed placards, and were told to go and wave them. Very Soviet, of course. But for some people, I mean, there's some kind of relatively natural patriotism and excitement that we can finally get Crimea back.
What about the peat in Belarus? You've just sort of written that off as a resource that somebody would be disappointed to lose.
And a point for the moderator for successfully incorporating peat into this conversation.
Thank you, Anne. So were Putin's moves expected?
Yes, mostly no. I think the general assumption has been that the whole point of dumping, you know, $50 billion into the most expensive Winter Olympics ever was supposed to buy a lot of PR. And so the idea that sort of a few weeks after this very successful Olympics, all that sort of paid for goodwill is squandered as a result of this, I think took a lot of people by surprise. In some ways, one can argue that perhaps no longer being distracted by the Olympics is what finally sort of resulted in Putin making that decision. The other thing to note is, I think it's always a little tricky for us to always treat all political actors as rational political actors, because I think just as the best explanation for Soviet invasion of Afghanistan is one that's fairly crude and I can't repeat it now that it's going to be on national public radio. The same thing could be said here. I mean, a lot of people called into question the mental health and stability of Putin, because it seemed like such an irrational thing to do right after all that money being spent. And we have a couple of more sort of Olympic-related ones.
Yeah, the one that's on the screen right now shows the Olympic rings above, and then below it, basically the tank treads using the same five rings.
This was one of the images. This is while the Olympics were going on. This is the Polish Newsweek, kind of a great example of, again, the attention is not where the attention needed to be, the kind of thing that would really irritate Putin.
And this shows the Olympic rings again, and this time one of the rings is a tire that's on fire.
And it's the ring that didn't open during the opening ceremonies as an extra bonus. This one is my favorite, my personal favorite. The animal itself, the one with the smiley face, not the one behind it, is a Russian children's character in books and cartoons. It's kind of a very well known, very benign and friendly figure. And of course, the idea sort of suggesting that behind that friendly facade lurks something much more menacing. Just.
Sometimes they speak for themselves, don't they? Unfortunately for radio, they don't. So, Anne, would you describe this
one,
please?
Sure. It depicts a tank and the three mascots of the Olympics, waving in a very friendly way, just as they did at the Olympics. And underneath the caption, instead of saying Sochi 2014, it says Krim, which is Russian and Ukrainian for Crimea 2014.
And so Ukraine obviously was in the Soviet Union. It theoretically should fall under the sphere of Russia now. Should we expect, and maybe this is a question for Jamie, maybe it's Anne, that many of these former Soviet republics have the potential to fall back into the sphere, or for that matter, to even become potentially part of Russia?
Well, I think in the big picture, what we're looking at right now is a continued settling out of the post-Cold War era. I mean, I think that what we see when we look at many of these independent states that used to be Soviet republics on the periphery of Russia, we're looking at a lot of countries whose future relations with Russia is uncertain. Some of them have and want stronger relations with Russia. Some very much don't want that. And I think, you know, we're in the middle of a pretty, you know, important historical process that could last another, you know, 10, 20 years or something. You know, and we'll have to see what happens.
And I think, I mean, the very assumption, right, that these are naturally in Russia's sphere of influence, right? I mean, it's a slightly, I mean, it's essentially sort of a, it's very much a post-World War II sort of assumption that this is rightfully Russia's. And certainly there are a lot of people in Russia, not just Putin, not just sort of his docile, you know, parliament, but a lot of other ordinary people who also feel that this is theirs in some way. When it comes to the people in these places, including Ukraine, I think the feelings are very different. And I think one of the really interesting things that we saw in Ukraine, for example, is that not everybody supported the protests. And certainly for Russian-speaking people, as once laws are getting passed that Russian is not an official language, you know, anymore, it made them very anxious and very nervous. But it's very striking that when the tanks started rolling, the vast majority of Russian-speaking Ukrainians were not thrilled by this. They felt, I mean, you know, there's a closer relationship with Russia, sure. Russian tanks in Ukraine, that's a different thing altogether. Interestingly, you know, the Crimean Tatar population in Crimea, definitely, I mean, sort of for them, this is definitely not a situation they particularly would like to revisit and see if it plays out differently, you know, the second time around. Notably, you know, they, when the many Ukrainian military bases, they're surrounded right now by, you know, spontaneous self-defense units, armed with Russian weapons, Russian equipment of all kinds. Many, ethnic Crimean Tatars are coming out to bring them food, to help support them during this time, because again, this is their way of demonstrating their commitment to wanting to be part of Ukraine rather than, you know, demonstrating that they want to throw their lot in with Russia.
So what is the world reaction at this point, to more generally? Jamie?
Yeah, well, right now what we see are a lot of different discussions about what should be done next within the EU, in the United States, and of course surrounding the United Nations. And I'll just point out a few things by looking at each of those three actors. First, the European Union. The European Union right now is putting together an aid package of about $15 billion, which is very important to Ukraine, whose economy, as I said before, is in very bad shape for a number of different reasons that quite predate this current crisis. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry says it needs about $35 billion. Europe and the U.S. are a little skeptical. Many officials in Europe and the U.S. are a little skeptical that it needs quite that much, but it certainly needs a lot of money. So Europe's putting together a big aid package. But the European Union also is quite typically somewhat divided over how to approach this. And, you know, it's easy to sort of, you know, often you hear this happen in the U.S., to make fun of the European Union for being sort of, not together on a foreign policy issue. But that's in part the way the European Union is designed. It's a very coherent economic union, but it's not at all intended to be a very coherent political or foreign policy union, so there are often disagreements. And so you see some countries, notably Germany, quite wary of making Russia angry. And so the Germans, who of course are in many ways the most powerful voice in the European Union, are, you know, wary, for example, of sanctions against Russia. And Germany relies heavily on, for example, natural gas imports from Russia. And so it and other countries, Italy also relies heavily on natural gas imports from Russia, are wary of doing much more. The United States is putting together an aid package, much smaller, at $1 billion, and it makes sense the Europeans would act more forcefully financially because Europe is much closer and they're much more interdependent with Russia. We're considering sanctions of various kinds. Maybe later on we can talk briefly about what types of options are available. But I think the U.S. is considering actions that are a little bit more forceful than the EU. And finally, the United Nations. You may have read that there have been emergency sessions held at the UN Security Council, and dramatic as the label of those sessions is, it's very important to note that nothing substantial will come out of the United Nations Security Council, because the way the United Nations Security Council is set up is that five countries have a veto over anything that it does, and of course one of those countries is Russia. The other four are the United States, China, Britain, and France. So the UN Security Council never does anything legally binding or at all forceful that goes against the interests of any of those five. So despite all this talk of emergency sessions and everything, don't expect anything, you know, substantial to come out of the United Nations Security Council. And the UN General Assembly, which is the other body we sometimes talk about, is barred from acting on any issue of national security so long as the Security Council is actually talking about it. And so it won't act. And the Security Council is talking about it in these emergency sessions. And the emergency sessions do have value. It's a place for, you know, ambassadors to come together and talk about these serious matters and to put their positions on the table, but we can't really expect action.
We should probably quickly point out that members of the IPFW Model UN Club, when they heard Jamie say Security Council, they very quickly sort of rolled their eyes and knew what that really meant, while the rest of us had to be educated. Jamie, you mentioned, you know, $30+ billion, another needed, $16 billion getting pledged already. That's a lot of money. And is it at all possible that Russia did not want to make those investments alone and instead of asking for assistance, found another way to convince people to make the investments for them?
Yeah, I think that's an interesting idea. And I think, you know, you do hear people suggest that. I would disagree. I don't think that probably was Russia's intent. I think Russia is more concerned with two things. Number one, keeping Ukraine within Russia's orbit. And the more it opens up Ukraine to Western aid and Western investment, et cetera, the more it loses out on that goal. And number two, I think Russia, and particularly Vladimir Putin, is more concerned with maintaining the issue of Russia as a strong global power. And again, I think it's not interested in seeing a country that it views as being within its sphere of influence being sort of gradually pulled into the Western orbit, even if through emergency loans and, you know, short-term dramatic assistance. So I doubt that.
Mm-hmm. So, Anne, what is Putin, do you think, hoping to get out of this?
The best explanation that I saw on social media was sort of that from Putin, you know, and sort of half joking, but I think it has an element of truth to it. That sure, it's great to in the history books to say Putin, you know, the guy who organized, you know, the best Winter Olympics in a warm climate ever. But how much better would it be to say to have your little paragraph say Putin, the guy who brought Crimea back into, you know, got Crimea back for Russia. And so I think part of this definitely has to do with kind of Putin thinking about the kind of legacy that he wants to, you know, that he wants to accomplish. But there are other elements here as well. I mean, there's sort of there's just kind of a symbolic dimension to this, right? I mean, this is a great way to sort of avenge all the past grievances that the West has visited upon Russia, right? You know, bombing Serbia without asking Russia, you know, the Kosovo thing. I mean, all the different things that have happened in the last couple of decades where Russia didn't want to happen that happened anyway because the United States or, you know, NATO or less so European Union wanted to have that happen. And so in a way, I mean, again, there's symbolic gesture. This is what I want to do, and therefore this is what's going to happen. There's concern. I mean, there's definitely concern that that Crimea, that if the Ukrainian government changes too much and it becomes too unfriendly to Russia, that this could jeopardize the military base and so on. It doesn't appear that actual all-out annexation is actually what's going to happen, but there are all sorts of ways of establishing a sphere of influence and without necessarily having to do an all-out annexation, sort of the rescuing of people, the protecting of the interests of the Russian of Russian speakers. I mean, there are all sorts of ways of creating a situation that appears politically legitimate without actually necessarily being so.
Are these justifications surprising or that are being used? Are they surprising?
I was a little bit. I mean, the military thing that was a little surprising. Sort of a weird thing to wake up to Saturday morning. Sort of, oh look, Putin is authorizing use of force. But the specific explanation that was given, I thought was particularly interesting for two reasons: for sort of a backward historic looking one, and a sort of forward future looking one. This idea that sometimes it's okay to intervene in a sovereign country's internal affairs to protect a national minority and a national minority's interests has a very rich and unfortunate historical, you know, tradition for the 20th century, right? I mean, this was the explanation for Hitler sort of going into the Sudetenlands, right, to protect Germans from the oppression of the Czechs and the Slovaks. This is the explanation for Anschluss. I mean, this is, and as a historian, right, I want to be particularly careful about the Hitler comparison, right, because, Twitter is all a Twitter with those comparisons. I mean, we have to be careful, but at the same time, I mean, this is not a particularly good kind of tradition to be in. But leaving aside, you know, let's leave aside the past, says the historian. Let's look towards the future instead. This issue of creating a recent precedent for it being okay, to go in to protect another ethnic group is particularly strange. Was particularly strange for me to hear for Russia, because this is something that could actually happen to Russia in the next couple of decades in the Far East. Russian population is not growing, and in many parts of the Far East, sort of the not very a slightly porous border between China and Russia has meant that there have been a lot of people from China coming over, settling in Russia. They're the ones who are actually growing the food to feed the region, and their numbers are growing. And so one can imagine a scenario where China could say, we have to come in here because our people are being oppressed, discriminated against, whatever that may be. And again, you know, Russian military is just not quite what it used to be. And you know, for a very long time it was a numbers game, and in a numbers game, Russia can't really match up to China at this point. So that's the part that particularly surprised me, because it just seemed that you could use so many other excuses. That one in particular seemed a little sort of concerning.
Short-sighted, perhaps.
Short-sighted. That's the word I was looking for.
So how is this, if we were to look into media in not only Russia, but Ukraine, and more specifically in Crimea, what would we actually be seeing right now? What's the reaction in those three areas, generally speaking?
In Russia, well, you saw the parades. There are also anti-war parades as well. They are much... it's funny. Funny story. You have to, in order to be able to do a parade in Russia, you actually have to apply for a permit a couple of weeks ahead of time. So there were all these jokes like, oh wow, all these people who were pro-war parading, they must have. I mean, how amazing is it that they applied for their, you know, the permits to go on these demonstrations weeks before any actual decision was made. On the other hand, the anti-war demonstrators. Not as well organized, because they're being bussed in from various, state enterprises. They're being sort of, they don't have the proper permits because it's too, they haven't applied for them yet. And so they're being, rounded up. And again, sort of the anti-Ukrainian propaganda is very, very strong, is very, very strong in Russia. And despite the efforts to try to discredit it, certainly that's not something that really shows up on Russian, on Russian television. In Ukraine, I think that there's kind of sheer kind of concern and horror. And again, Russia's military, for all its weaknesses, is stronger than Ukrainian military, because Ukrainian military has similar problems and even fewer resources. And so as a result, I mean, there are people who are signing up to volunteer to, I mean, it's actually, Ukraine has a professional army, but they're not people signing up to volunteer because they anticipate that's something that might actually happen. But there's a lot of fear and concern of how exactly this is going to play out. In Crimea, it seems particularly complicated, because there is a considerable contingent in Crimea of people who view themselves as Russian, who hate the fact that they ended up by sheer sort of, collapse politics in Ukraine, and they're pretty excited at the possibility that they might end up with Russian passports instead of Ukrainian passports. So there's definitely, so that's the segment of the Russian-speaking people. The Ukrainians and the Crimean Tatars certainly have severe concerns and really kind of trying to prevent the turnover of the military bases to Russia.
So Jamie, from an international perspective, why does this small area matter to us? Why should we care about what ends up being a fairly small amount of land?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I think we should care for a number of reasons. Number one, of course, I think what interests a lot of Americans are the concerns over human rights, democracy, authoritarianism, that kind of thing. And And so we care as citizens about, you know, what happens to people in other parts of the world. I think more broadly, at a more strategic level, we can realize that this also is a potential confrontation between two, you know, nuclear-armed great powers, the United States and Russia. Not that we'd go to war, I'm not saying that, but what I mean is that this is sort of a test of wills. And it's a political struggle, not a military one, of course, but a political struggle between the U.S. and Russia. You know, and people have been saying for some years now, oh, you know, the bad relations between the U.S. and Russia, it's like a new Cold War. Now, anyone who lived through the old Cold War knows that this is nothing like a Cold War. However, you know, when we look at this situation, things are, you know, worse than they've been at any point since 1991. So, you know, we need to take a look at this, and it is interesting and important and worrisome. I think the big question here that I would raise is whether this whole situation is a demonstration of Russian strength fundamentally or of Russian weakness. And my position is that it's really more a demonstration of Russian weakness than of Russian strength. I mean, if you look at the images in the news, you know, and you see Russian soldiers or so-called Russian soldiers, and you see, you know, the military might, and you look at Vladimir Putin, who projects this strong, very manly image, right? And so, you know, you might think, wow, this is pretty impressive. You know, you might not like it, but you think this is Russia being strong. Well, I think in many ways this is a demonstration of Russia's weakness. I mean, the fact that it had to do this to sort of hold on to some influence in a country, Ukraine, that possibly was sort of slipping more out of its orbit, I think is you know, suggests at least that, you know, this was not Russia's preferred course of action. It much would have preferred to have managed Ukraine in sort of a peaceful manner in which it could continue to sort of subtly dominate it, but now had to do this because it really had few other options on the table. And we will look around the world too at other things that Russia is doing. I think we also see demonstrations of Russia's weakness masked pretty cleverly by Vladimir Putin as demonstrations of Russian strength. I mean, if we look in Syria, for example, we see Russia desperately trying to hold on to its last real military ally in the Middle East after, you know, during the Cold War, being an important power in the Middle East. Of course, Russia still has relations with Iran, et cetera, but not in the same way as with Syria. And if we look at the Russian economy in many ways is not doing well. It's been riding the wave of high commodities prices for a long time, but that's not going to last forever. And we see that Russia already has suffered tremendously in the last few days. The price of the ruble against the dollar has reached an all-time low on Monday. International investors are pulling lots of money out of the stock market in Moscow. And so I think that Putin is having to pay a considerable price for what's going on now, and I doubt very much that this was a course of action that he would have wanted to take.
And from a historical perspective, why should we care about what amounts to a very small area?
Can I add one more thing to what
Sure.
Still said? Economic, I mean, as far as the economy is concerned, and again, this is that issue of sort of rational, kind of Putin as a rational international player or not. I mean, this is very costly in the short run, and best case scenario, if Crimea does fall more squarely into Russia's sphere of influence, this will cost Russia even more money, right? Because certainly there's no way that any aid from the West is going to be allowed to go in there. And, you know, looking at the examples in other places where Russia has sort of done something similar, right? Abkhazia and Ossetia and so on. It costs a lot of money to be able to keep those people sort of happy in that sphere of influence. And so the kind of, again, that juxtaposition, the desire to project power and strength symbolic is going to come at a huge, huge cost. And again, on the heels of the huge cost of the Olympics, which of course is coming out of essentially people's pensions and various other social welfare programs. And this is going to mean even more sort of tightening of the belts for people in Russia in order to pay for these grandiose, very ambitious kind of imperial, you know, we can even say designs on the part of Putin, who is establishing his legacy and his personal glory and possibly compensating for all sorts of things. That was Professor Toole's point about projection. So.
Well, let's go back to Professor Toole for a moment. What can the world do to help resolve the issue here?
Okay, well, I think it's important to point out that there are very few easy options here. I mean, diplomacy often presents you with unattractive options, and it does in this case as well. First thing to say, as I said before, is there is no military option on the table for anybody, and I don't think that's even say President Obama's harshest critics are not, of course, suggesting that. So we look at diplomatic options, and And of course, economic sanctions are there. And I'm assuming we're talking about options for sort of for punishing Russia, you know, as opposed to helping Ukraine. And one thing that's being discussed are targeted sanctions and asset freezes. Targeted sanctions, which include visa bans, travel bans on individual high-level members of the Russian political elite, and asset freezes. So freezes of the assets that members of the Russian elite hold abroad. This would actually be quite a considerable step to take. It's usually considered a minor step to take with sanctions, but depending on how long you make the list of individual people who'd be targeted, this could be a pretty big deal because, as many of you know, there are a lot of vastly wealthy Russians with a whole lot of assets outside Russia, in Switzerland, in the U.S., you know, buying huge apartments in New York City and, you know, in London, et cetera, a huge emigre population of wealthy Russians in London and other places. So you could really put a lot of pain on the Russian elite if you wanted to do that. But that would, of course, be very controversial because these are very powerful people. So I wouldn't expect too much of that. But traditionally, that's one of the first easy steps is to slap travel bans and asset freezes on high-level members of the elite. And so with Russia, that would be a pretty controversial thing. There's also discussion of some comprehensive sanctions. In other words, sanctions that would affect the country as a whole and not just individual people. And the U.S. is thinking of this, considering sanctions on the Russian banking sector, for example. But again, that would be a pretty big step. And I would suggest again that the European Union countries generally would not agree with these things. And so we'd be going it alone in many cases if we were to go ahead with that sort of thing. There may be some arms embargoes that countries put on Russia. Not that that would affect Russia's military power. It would be more symbolic, but it would be a way of demonstrating disapproval. And you know, one thing that people are talking about that is much more likely is some kind of boycott of the upcoming G8 summit, which is going to be held in Sochi, Russia. So this would be a real slap in the face, you know, to Russia and its prestige if this summit were not to be held or were boycotted by many members of the G8, which is sort of the world's kind of preeminent group of a small club of rich countries. And it's worth pointing out that Russia was invited to join the G8 back in the 1990s when really economically it had no reason to let Russia in because Russia didn't have the same level of economic development as the original G7. Russia was let in for political reasons to support the then development of Russian democracy. So, you know, there might be some scaling back of cooperation in that group. But, you know, when you look at those options, there are not many options there. It's noteworthy that, for example, people who are criticizing President Obama for not doing much aren't really proposing much either because there are so few options. So the criticism of Obama lately has been more about criticizing the president for how we got here and for how somehow, you know, President Obama allowed this to happen, rather than saying that, you know, that there are other options that Obama should be pursuing, because frankly, there aren't many.
Anne, what do you think the world could be doing?
I think part of it, I guess, the first question that should be asked is, what would we like to accomplish? What would we like to accomplish? Because the examples that Professor Teal mentioned, especially sort of the soft power things, that actually has a lot. I mean, it's not necessarily seen as a potentially big deal. Oh my God, you can't travel to, you know, you can't travel to the West. You can't travel to to the United States or Western Europe. It is a kind of a big deal. It's a huge deal in Russia. And in a sense, there's almost this kind of a social contract between the wealthy elites in Russia and the government. The government allows them to accumulate their wealth without any limits and any kind of concerns about how they acquire that wealth, right? As long as they don't involve themselves in political activity of any, you know, of any kind. It allows them to travel abroad. It allows them to, you know, to have this amazing a life that really wealthy people can have. In exchange, all they need to do is not question the regime, not criticize the regime, and spew various patriotic drivel that they're supposed to do. And so the same people who sort of to talk about the decadent West and the West that's that's horrific and the gays who are ruining the West. I mean, a lot of really really ugly propaganda is coming out of the mouth of people whose children are being educated in the West, who own mansions in the West. And so this would really hurt them, right? Because in a way, I mean, they can have their decadent Western life, you know, in their spare time, and professionally be the sort of the condemners and the denigrators of the West. And so again, if what we want is to perhaps reduce this unconditional support that Putin has been able to have, this is something that might actually work, and that might actually hurt, even though it doesn't seem like that big of a deal.
Over the next few days, or weeks and months for that matter, what should we be watching for?
Okay. Oh, I'd just say a few things. One, obviously any further Russian military moves, although Putin seems to have ruled that out, and I think maybe we're seeing the beginning of some kind of status quo as to how far Russia's willing to go in Crimea and Ukraine. So I think two other things. One, we want to look at the extent of sanctions that are, you know, discussed. You know, are people talking about more dramatic ones, less dramatic ones? How many people would be included in a list for asset freezes and travel bans, et cetera? And the other thing to look at, I think, is the various positions of the European Union members. So unity versus division within the European Union, and particularly, I would say, the role of Germany. How hard or soft is Germany willing to be on Russia?
Anne?
One of the most remarkable things that has happened in the last couple of days, and we've been making jokes about this, you know, for the last 40 minutes, is that suddenly the announcement on the part of Putin, the Minister of Defense, and every foreign minister of Russia, that these were not Russian military after all. And very conveniently, I think we have an image where they all have, all of these soldiers and officers have brand new uniforms that have no insignia whatsoever, right? There's no rank insignia, there's no army insignia, and the names, absolutely nothing. There it is. Oh, previous one, sorry. There it is, right? I mean, absolutely none whatsoever. Brand new uniforms that they were issued. And so now the official word is there are no Russian forces in there. These are all spontaneously formed local, you know, self-defense organizations that happen to have military, you know, Russian military equipment, you know, Russian weapons. But that's all a coincidence. And I mean, literally, sort of the argument is you can buy that anywhere, right? Lots of other former Soviet republics have uniforms that are very similar. They could be from anywhere. You can buy these kind of weapons anywhere, right? That's, you know, they bought them in the store. And this is not playing, this is actually not playing very well, in part because I think these young people are kind of confused because they, you know, they certainly see themselves as fulfilling their military duty. And the fact that they're being repudiated in this way is seen as is offending people, right? Because in part, it's already seen as, this can play out in a couple of different ways, including if this does turn violent, and so far it hasn't, right? I mean, it appears that there've been a lot of, I mean, Russia seems determined for Ukraine to shoot first, right? Because the moment Ukraine shoots, that's the moment that Russia can say, see, we needed to be here to protect them and save them, and here's proof. And so far, Ukraine, I mean, to their credit, they've really sort of, despite all the provocations, they haven't shot yet. But if something goes wrong, this is something that could give Russia the excuse, these were not ours, right? We don't have to pay them, we don't have to compensate their families if something happens to them. And this does not play very well internally. And so in some ways, I'm most curious about how this is going to continue to play out in Russia, because there are a lot of kind of, once again, the possibility for anti-Putin protests, in part because the idea that you're going to fight Ukraine, I mean, that seems to be something that's very problematic for a lot of people. Why are we fighting our fellow Slavic brothers, you know, fellow Christians? I mean, leaving aside who you should be fighting and who we would be okay to start shooting at. And so it'll be very interesting to see how this, you know, how this continues to play out internally in Russia.
That's all the time we have for this edition of WBOY Presents. Special thanks go to IPFW professors James Toole and Anne Lifshitz and Andrew Downs, along with the university's Special Events Department for helping us with the sound. This episode was produced by Katie Anderson and myself. I'm Sean Beter. Thanks for joining us this week for WBOY Presents.